Chaka Khan, and you're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM.
Good morning. It's 7 a.m. and 52 degrees in Central Park. We'll see a high near 70. And it will be mostly sunny with some likely showers earlier today. And today is Tuesday, May 4th, 2021. You're tuned to listener-sponsored, non-commercial, free speech radio, WBAI New York. Coming up next, a new day. This morning, we'll have a conversation with Cruz Fuchsman, a social worker and community liaison at the New York Psychotherapy and Counseling Center. This past March, for Women's History Month, Ms. Cruz was among a group of 11 women who were honored at an event celebrating women from the Bronx. We'll talk to Ms. Cruz about her work here in New York City, and we'll ask her questions about her dramatic journey from the Dominican Republic to the United States. Stay tuned for headlines. Wonder where we disappear periodically, once a week, sometimes twice a week. Well, the fundraising schedule of WBAI changes every week, and we are usually off when the station needs to fundraise. So that's what happened to us last Friday and yesterday, which meant that we all did on the team a four-day break, which was great. And you can probably hear that in my voice, can't you? This is your update on the COVID-19 pandemic. On May 3rd, USA Today reported that according to the World Health Organization, more than 1 billion vaccine doses have been administered globally. But that 82% of these shots have been given in high and middle income countries, and in only 0.3% of low income countries. Winnie Bainimia, executive director of UNAIDS, said in a brief April 28th, hosted by the One Campaign, an anti-poverty and global health nonprofit, that, quote, "This has created an apartheid. We knew it was coming. We have allowed it to happen," unquote.
As we've seen with HIV, and as we now see with coronavirus, epidemics affect everyone, but they do not affect everyone equally. To fight COVID, we have to fight inequality, because pandemics feed on and widen inequalities. No one should be sent to the back of the COVID queue because of the color of their skin or the money in their pocket.
The vaccine divide is further exacerbated by India's crisis. India is home to the world's largest vaccine manufacturer, but has restricted COVID-19 vaccine exports amid its own domestic surge in COVID-19 cases. International aid groups and global health advocates are ramping up pressure on the U.S. and other G7 countries to take a range of steps to expand vaccine access. These steps include sharing more of their own vaccine doses with low-income countries and waiving pharmaceutical companies' vaccine patents to encourage the mass distribution and production of vaccines globally. And police in the United States are overwhelmingly acting without oversight. There are approximately 18,000 law enforcement units across the country, yet only about 160 municipalities and counties here in the United States have implemented some form of civilian oversight of police through civilian complaint review boards, inspectors general, and independent monitors. Another 130 localities are trying to do so. This, according to officials from the National Association for Civilian Oversight of Law Enforcement. This represents just a fraction, right? 160 plus 130 represents just a fraction of the 18,000 law enforcement units nationwide. The issue of civilian oversight of police is back on the table in the media, among policymakers and activists, ever since the uprisings that thrust 35 to 40 million people into the streets after the killings of Breonna Taylor and George Floyd last year. The results of a recent Department of Justice-funded survey by the same organization, Civilian Oversight of Law Enforcement, found that 38 of the 64 so-called police oversight groups that responded to the study have no independent investigative authority and are limited to doing audits to determine whether internal affairs investigators were thorough and followed policies. So part of what you're hearing here is that there are very, very few oversight entities in this country under 300 oversight entities in the country that has 18,000 law enforcement units. But of those less than 300 oversight groups, the majority of them, all of them, have very, very little power. Again, 38 of the 64 so-called police oversight groups that responded to this Department of Justice study say that they have no independent investigative authority and are limited to doing audits. 30 of the groups cannot issue subpoenas, and 23 have no access to open internal affairs files. And for those that can suggest disciplinary action, chiefs and police arbitrators usually can reject their recommendations. In many cities, oversight of the police has been limited by strict collective bargaining agreements with police unions. And in 22 states, laws known as officers' bills of rights limit the scope of police oversight. On the opinion page of a December 2020 issue of City Limits, the editor said the following, quote, "No entity can police itself, least of all the police. So if the CCRB is to live up to its mandate for independent oversight of police misconduct in New York City, it must make the final decision on discipline for officers found to have engaged in misconduct. It must have the final decision on discipline for officers found to have engaged in misconduct," unquote. Jim Pasco, the current executive director of the National Fraternal Order of Police, recently said that allowing civilian oversight, quote, "would be akin to putting a plumber in charge of the investigation of airplane crashes," unquote. So essentially, the Fraternal Order of Police and police unions will not have it. They will have nothing of civilian oversight of police misconduct. And New York State lawmakers are expected to extend New York's eviction moratorium until August 31st. The extension means any New York tenant who has submitted a hardship declaration form will be protected from eviction for the next 4 months. This would buy tenants some time to apply to the state's rent relief program, which opens up next month. The extension covers everything in the current moratorium passed at the end of last year, including residential foreclosures and tax lien sales. The old moratorium expired on May 1st, but the court confirmed that cases will be paused until the new moratorium is back in place. Lawmakers acknowledged that New York State is still in a pandemic and COVID-19 is still affecting people's health and incomes. Meanwhile, the state's new $2.4 billion rent relief program is not up and it's not running yet. So tenant advocates and lawmakers push to extend the current eviction moratorium until people have the chance to apply for relief. This is Justin Cope, an attorney representing tenants in New York City.
Rent relief is only the tip of the iceberg in terms of what the tenant community needs in order to be put on equal footing with landlords. And I do think rent cancellation would be a big step forward in providing the relief that tenants need to avoid eviction.
And have you any idea how Washington Heights became the little Dominican Republic, how Dominicans came to dominate American baseball, and how the Dominican salon came to be highly sought after by women of color dead set on getting a Dominican blowout? Well, it all started when the first democratically elected president of the Dominican Republic, Juan Bosch, was taken out of power by U.S.-supported military coup in 1963, only 7 months after Juan Bosch had been sworn into office.
In office only 7 months, President Juan D. Bosch of the Dominican Republic has been deposed. The head of the country's first legally elected government in 38 years, President Bosch was overthrown in a pre-dawn bloodless coup directed by military leaders. Generals Antonio Imbert Barreras and Luis Amiamatio are among those heading the Santo Domingo revolt. An action set to have its roots in scenes like these. A communist rally. The military accused Bosch of being soft on communism, claiming his policies were leading to a Castro-like government for the Republic. The new regime has proclaimed a state of siege throughout the country, also imposing a curfew. Washington was disturbed by the overthrow, and the United States State Department temporarily suspended diplomatic relations and halted all aid. The Kennedy administration had supported President Bush's government with $75 million.
And that was from the Associated Press archive, and it's titled Military Coup in the Dominican Republic, and it was aired in 1963. So what happened exactly? The military and the colonel who led the operation, Elias Wesson, overthrew Juan Bosch and established a military junta. This is in the Dominican Republic. Why? Oh, because the military and this colonel didn't like the fact that Bosch was moving quickly to affirm the rights of labor, unions, and farmers in the new Dominican Constitution. He was also moving quickly to affirm the rights of homeless people and pregnant women, and the rights of the family, the rights of children and the young, and of all legally unrecognized children. And by the way, the Catholic Church was also opposed to Juan Bosch's presidency. The U.S. didn't like any of his talk either. And less than 2 years later, a popular uprising ushered in another military action of the revolutionary variety this time. On April 24, 1965, Colonel Francisco Camaño led a military campaign. And as a result of this military campaign, the junta was unseated within 4 days. And a new military leadership that was instituted by this military campaign of the revolutionary variety called for the restitution of Juan Bosch, the country's first democratically elected president. The United States invaded the island nation immediately thereafter in support of the anti-Bosch forces. And they did it, as we would say in Spanish, pero rápido, and violently suppressed a popular revolution. So once again, this is what happens. Juan Bosch is elected president in 1963. Actually, he's elected president in 1962 in December, and he's sworn in 1963. Within 7 months, there's a coup against him, supported by the U.S. military. Why? Because Juan Bosch has a social democratic set of policies that he's instituting, and he comes to be hated by the military, the Catholic Church, and the old ruling class under the former dictator Leonidas Trujillo, who himself was killed in 1960. So there is an enormous amount of turmoil in the Dominican Republic, but the beginnings of a popular uprising. Within 2 years of Juan Bosch's being deposed from government by a military coup, liberals and radicals within the military launch a military campaign to unseat the military junta that had been put in place when Bosch was thrown out in 63. And immediately, of course, the United States invades the Dominican Republic in 1965. And to diffuse political pressure and revolutionary fervor on the island, the U.S. simultaneously opens up its borders to Dominican immigration. So the consulate in the Dominican Republic, the embassy, of the United States starts handing out visas like hotcakes. And so it was that Dominicans began settling in Washington Heights in 1965. They settled in the Heights and the Bronx in progressively larger numbers in the late 1960s and throughout the 1970s and 1980s. And it's 7:20 a.m. and 54 degrees in Central Park. You're tuned to listener-sponsored WBAI at 99.5 FM in New York. I'm Johanna Fernandez, your host of A New Day.
Me dio una sirimba un domingo en la mañana cuando menos lo pensaba. Caí redondo como una guanábana sobre la alcantarilla. ¿Será la presión o me ha subido la bilirrubina? Y me entró una calentura y me fui poniendo blanco como bola en naftalina. Me llevaron a un hospital de gente, supuestamente. En la emergencia recepcionista escuchaba la lotería. Alguien se apiada de mí, grité perdiendo el sentido. Y una enfermera se acercó a mi oreja y me dijo, tranquilo Bobby, tranquilo. Acarició con sus manos de Bengay y me dijo, ¿qué le pasa, atleta? Y le conté con lujo de detalles lo que me había sucedido. Hay que chequearte la presión, pero la sala está ocupada. Y mi querido, en este hospital no hay luz para un electrocardiograma. Abrí los ojos como luna llena y me agarré la cabeza. Porque es muy duro pasar el Niágara en bicicleta.
No me digas que los médicos te fueron.
Me escribió muy dulcemente, lo siento atleta. Me acarició con sus manos de Bengay y siguió su destino. Lo oí claramente cuando dijo otro paciente, tranquilo Bobby. Bajé los ojos a media asta y me agarré la cabeza. Porque es muy duro pasar el Niágara en bicicleta.
No me digas que los médicos se fueron. No me digas que no tienen anestesia.
And that was El Niágara en Bicicleta by Juan Luis Guerra, which translates into traversing the Niagara on a bicycle. This past March for Women's History Month, the Mott Haven Community Partnership, a nonprofit community center in the Boogie Down Bronx, celebrated, quote, Women from the Bronx, in the form of an event that highlighted some of their community partners' contributions to the city. Cruz Fuchsman was honored during that event as a woman from the Bronx, and so was I. Nine other women were celebrated similarly that night during a panel presentation in which we were asked to answer a series of questions about our work and personal lives. It was during this conversation that I learned something personal, moving, and dramatic about Cruz Fuchsman. Today, Ms. Fuchsman is a licensed social worker, a graduate of one of the city's highest-ranked schools in her profession, the Hunter College School of Social Work. But getting here from her native Dominican Republic wasn't easy. It literally took parting the seas. When she shared a snippet of her story at that event, I wanted to know more. And we've been trying to coordinate this interview for a few weeks, and so I'm very happy that she's joining us this morning. Ms. Cruz has over 30 years of experience working with children, individuals, and families. Currently, she is the community liaison of the New York Psychotherapy and Counseling Center. In this position, she brings information and training on all types of mental health subjects to individuals and communities in the five boroughs of New York City. Ms. Cruz, welcome to A New Day. I think we might have lost Ms. Cruz. Ms. Cruz, are you there? So while we wait for Ms. Cruz, I played that song El Niágara en Bicicleta by Juan Luis Guerra, a very classic, popular song, not just in the Dominican Republic, but in Latin America, I think. And it's essentially a treatise on the difficulties of navigating healthcare in a hospital, in a public hospital with very few resources in the Dominican Republic. And so Juan Luis Guerra suggests that dealing with the healthcare system, an impoverished healthcare system in the Dominican Republic, is like attempting to traverse the Niagara on a bicycle. It's a really beautiful song with a lot of really fascinating and interesting analogies. Okay, so we've got Ms. Cruz back on the line. Ms. Cruz, welcome to A New Day.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me. What
Good
an
morning.
Honor.
Well, it is my honor to speak with you, and I don't know if you heard much of the introduction, but I'd like to start by asking you about your work at the New York Psychotherapy and Counseling Center. What do you do? But what is the New York Psychotherapy and Counseling Center?
Yes. Good morning, everyone. Yes, the New York Psychotherapy and Counseling Center is an outpatient mental health program that serves children, adolescents, adults, and families throughout the five boroughs. Our outpatient mental health clinics have programs in the Bronx and have programs in Brooklyn, in the Bushwick and East New York sessions. And we are the only outpatient mental health provider that opens 7 days a week, the only provider that does not hold a wait list ever. So an individual called in for an appointment today, we will be able to intake the person on the same day. And we have doctors and all licensed social workers that are available either in person or through telehealth. We have been in existence for over 45 years, serving individuals and families throughout the five boroughs.
And so that's the New York Psychotherapy and Counseling Center, which was opened in 1974. So this organization is a product of the struggles to expand the experience of democracy in the United States in the 1960s through the expansion of mental health services and community centers focused on mental health. This is important because a lot of New Yorkers probably don't realize that this service is available to them. So this is a center that's open 7 days a week, probably not 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and it admits or offers services to patients who are having mental health issues.
That is correct. And one very important highlight about this organization is that throughout the pandemic, our organization remained open. There is a team of four of us and one of the outreach person, and we actually walk through the city, the streets of the Bronx, Brooklyn, during the pandemic, just bringing information, every food distribution site to every mask distribution site, And even now, with the vaccine, every vaccination site, we have been there every day of the week, bringing information to the community about mental health, because we knew that there were going to be a lot of hesitancy with people getting the train to go to the clinic. So we wanted to make sure that people knew that the mental health could be provided in the comfort of your home, that you could either see the therapist through the telephone or through, you know, video camera, but that there were services available to you 7 days a week. And we have continued to do that from the day one of the pandemic and up until now.
And can you give us a sense of how folks can reach the New York Psychotherapy and Counseling Center? Is there a number, a hotline? How do you make an appointment?
Yes, so there are many ways. As I mentioned, our clinic, even though we don't provide the telehealth 24/7, you can get in contact with our agency. If you call the main number of our organization, you will be answered, and you will be connected with a therapist. So our telephone number for the main office is 718-553-3100, and you can visit our website at www.nypcc.org, and also, you know, we have the number at each clinic that they can call. If they wanted to get in contact with us with the Bronx clinic, they can call 718-485-2100, and for the Brooklyn clinics, it's the 718-235-3100 or 718-602-1000. But if these numbers get a little bit messed up, visiting our website, nypcc.org, you will be able to get in contact with us. And the community, the outreach team, participate on all types of events and activities in the community, from health fairs. We provide, presentations about the services. We pick up all the calls that come in, even in the middle of the night when people call our numbers. Our numbers are answered. I mean, we answer calls, 24/7. Maybe the therapeutic service, Dr. Fernandez, are not at 2 o'clock in the morning, but if someone calls us at those hours, we will pick up the phone, because we understand that we are struggling right now, especially during the pandemic, with, mental health issues. And even individuals that didn't have a history of mental health issues now are struggling, and now are starting to see signs and symptoms that something is not going well. So we just wanted to be there. We want to be considered pioneer in mental health, services. So we are an organization that you can lean on, you can rely on, and that you can trust. That when you make a phone call to us, we will not let you down. We will guide you through services, and we want people to get better. We want our community to get better. We want our children to get better. And the only way to provide that support is by being there when people knock on our doors.
And the name of the organization is the New York Psychotherapy and Counseling Center, and you can go online to find information at its website. That's NY as in New York, psycho, NYPCC, NYP as in Paul, C as in cat, C as in cat. Is it .org?
That's all correct.
NYPCC.org. All of this information is going to be in our show notes. So if you go to the archive of A New Day on WBAI's website, you'll find it, including the number. The main number is 718-553-3100, 718-553-3100. And I was going to ask you just very briefly, what does the picture of mental health look like for New Yorkers and your clients under the pandemic? What kinds of issues have you seen?
Dr. Fernandez, you're getting cut off. I missed the question.
What does the picture of mental health look like for New Yorkers and your clients under the pandemic? Like, what kinds of issues have you seen?
Yeah, that's a good question. So what we're seeing during this pandemic is a lot of anxiety and depression. There is a lot of grief. People were very anxious about, you know, the unknown. People were dealing with a lot of loss of employment, loss of their own health, loss of their loved ones. There was a lot of uncertainty. People were really dealing with the fear about what's going to come next. Mm. There's a lot of grief. We are seeing a lot of children and a lot of adults grieving. There are children that lost their grandparents, that they were never able to touch them or to say goodbye. Adults lost also their primary caretaker. They lost husband, they lost wife, they lost family member. And I think that it's very important for a lot of the people that we treat, you know, especially, you know, brown and black families that are really, I mean, being there for family is part of their tradition. And just having to lose an individual without being able to say goodbye was very traumatic. And the pandemic was traumatic. That's something that families and individuals and children were not expecting. For kids to just coming home from school one day and then the next day the school is closed, that was very traumatic. So we dealing with this trauma of this pandemic and the grief and the separation and the social isolation. This is what we are, you know, seeing right now, and this is what we're, you know, what we're dealing with. And there might be other things that will layer, you know, later. But for now, you know, stress, anxiety, and grief is taking a toll, in our communities.
So I think it's very important to talk about the pandemic and the changes in our lives that came unexpected with that term, trauma, because if trauma goes unaddressed, it manifests in all kinds of different ways, through anxiety, but also through physical illnesses.
That is correct.
So we're encouraging folks to talk about their feelings, to seek help, and you can seek help through this organization, the New York Psychotherapy and Counseling Center. Now, one of the reasons why I invited you to this program was because of what you shared with us during that beautiful event honoring women from the Bronx. And I don't know if you listened to my introduction, but this is what you did. Okay. So it was during that conversation that I learned something very personal, moving, and dramatic. And I say here that even though you were a licensed social worker today and you studied in one of the most prestigious schools of social work, the Hunter College School of Social Work, getting here and being where you are now was no easy feat, and it literally took parting the seas. Can you give us a sense of what your life was like in the Dominican Republic and how you arrived here in the United States?
Yeah, thank you so much, Dr. Fernandez. I actually, when I was listening to the song from Juan Luis Guerra, that song really, it's very close to my heart because it's almost reminding me of my story. You know, I am number 5 of 7 children. My mom was a single mom, uneducated woman. She grew up in a farm with her mother, also a single mom, and came to the capital when she was in her 20s to work for a better life. And so it was hard. My mom was a laundress. She would wash and iron clothing for rich people to support the family. And I saw that every day. My mom left the house every day to wash clothes. And that was not, we didn't have a washing machine at the time. She was literally washing clothes with her hands for rich individuals, and came home every day with swollen and bleeding fingers. And then in the morning, she would go back again. And so in seeing that growing up, I didn't want that. I want a better life for me and for my family. So I wanted to be a doctor. My goal was to really go to medical school. I had a lot of passion for helping people, and I identified myself with that career as a way to really go into the campus, go into the farm, and provide medical help to people that couldn't come to the city for that. But that was impossible because in the Dominican Republic, you know, as you know, the University of Santo Domingo was, the only university where poor people could attend. But there were so many political problems at the time that I was growing up where the university was closed, 6 or 7 months out of the year. So there was no way that I wouldn't be able to go to medical school there. I would have to apply for a private school, and my family didn't have money for that. So it was hard. I must say that we didn't have much. Remember when I was a teenager, my bed was sitting on four blocks, cement blocks, because my bed didn't have it left. I had one pair of shoes that I went to school with, and I went to any errand, any Sunday event, it was all the same pair of shoes. But there was a lot of love. My mom was a very loving and caring woman. We worked hard, but show us the hard work. I had my first job when I was 13. I worked in a drugstore. It was the closest I can get to be a doctor, working in a drugstore. And I was pretty, pretty bright about, learning about the ingredients that the medication was made of and prescribing medication to people that came to the drugstore. And so then there was an opportunity where a friend said to me, life is hard here. I went to Puerto Rico and I was deported and I want to go back. You want to hop on the boat with me? And I was like, in a boat to Puerto Rico? Yes, and you'll be fine. And she painted me this beautiful trip.
Ms. Cruz, before you, let's put a little stop there. You're listening to the voice of Ms. Cruz Fuchsman, a graduate of Hunter College School of Social Work. Ms. Cruz has over 30 years of experience working with children, individuals, and families. She's currently the community liaison of the New York Psychotherapy and Counseling Center. And we're talking about her life in the Dominican Republic and how she arrived here to first to Puerto Rico and then to the U.S. mainland. I'm Johanna Fernandez, your host of A New Day, and you're listening to WBAI at 99.5 FM in New York. Before you tell us about the trip, where were your parents from? Where are your peoples from? What town in the Dominican Republic?
Yes, my mom was born in the north, in what is called Puerto Plata, mm-hmm. in the Dominican Republic, and she left the village in Puerto Plata to go to Santo Domingo. So I was born in Santo Domingo, in the capital. So where other of my brothers and brothers were born also in the capital.
And when and what years were you referring to when there were strikes at the public university, the Autonomous University of Santo Domingo, the UAS?
What year was about? Well, it was late 70s, early 80s.
Yes.
You will hear, even when I was in high school, you will hear the political problem, students rising for more benefits, for more, access to books. And there was always the university was on the news. There was a struggle between the government and the students and police and the students. There was always problem in the university. And I would want to say that was very late 70s and early 80s at the time.
And part of what we see happening, not just in the Dominican Republic, but throughout Latin America in the 80s especially, are the fruits of policies initiated by the World Bank to privatize the the public sector in countries like the Dominican Republic, but also in other countries in Latin America. So there, these countries had taken out loans to survive, and part of what the World Health, the IMF, the World Bank, was instituting were policies, what we call neoliberal policies, policies that encouraged or forced these countries to privatize the public sector in exchange for continued support, financial support, and for loans. In any case, so that's part of what is going on with the students going out on strike, but there was also a period in the Dominican Republic of public sector workers going out on strike because conditions were really dire. Ms. Cruz, continue. Oh, did we lose Ms. Cruz? All right. I'm talking to Cruz Fuchsman, who's the community liaison of New York Psychotherapy and Counseling Center. And we're about to talk to her about her journey from the Dominican Republic to the United States. And I heard the contours of her journey during a celebration of women from the Bronx that was sponsored by the Mott Haven Community Partnership, a nonprofit community center in the Boogie Down Bronx. And when I heard her story, I thought our listening audience would benefit tremendously from listening to her perspective and how she arrived. Ms. Cruz, Tell us about your journey to the United States.
Yeah, so I came from the Dominican Republic to Puerto Rico, as I mentioned earlier, in a boat. It was a very hard experience for a 17-year-old who never got separated from my mom and my siblings. The only place I ever visited in the Dominican Republic was Puerto Plata. Every summer, I was a very good student with good grades, and a gift for having a successful school year, they would send me to the countryside to my grandmother to spend summer. But leaving the country, I just felt that it was an opportunity to get on a boat and just opened the door for a better life for myself and for my family. I must mention, however, and that's always been important to me to say, and thank you for providing me this opportunity, is that when you do these things, you're not thinking about the illegal aspect of it. If anybody will ask me at the time, you know that you're doing something illegal, right? I would be like, no, because I didn't know. It is, once I was here and learned about it, like, oh, sneaking in a country illegally is a crime. So you don't think about that when you do that. You're driven by the necessity, by wanting to have a better life. And that's what I did. So I got to Puerto Rico. We arrived through what is called Cabo Rojo for, you know, a couple of days in the water, to come to the mountain somewhere there. I didn't even tell you which is that part of Cabo Rojo we arrived. Well, we arrived and we're there in a week in a outdoor, beaten by mosquitoes and all kind of insects for a week. And then coming out a week later to Santurce, to Puerto Rico, and just relying on goodwill and good people that will, we knock on doors of friends that my friend have and feed us and give us clothing. And so and that's when the life began, to really struggle, cleaning houses for money, taking care of children for money, to, you know, help my family and my mom. I made sure that every penny I make, I was sending money there. And then it continues coming to New York. I didn't have a college degree when I got here. I used to work in a factory and on Fifth Avenue in Brooklyn, working in a factory from, you know, 7:30 in the morning to 6 o'clock, and then running from that factory, get on the bus to get to the Richwood Bushwick Senior Center to get English classes. And I was very, very committed to learn English because I really wanted to go to school and I wanted to do better. And I've been blessed. I have a lot of struggles in this country, like everybody does. I'm sure there's a lot of immigrants that come here and they really have to suffer eating, Oriental soups, the one that were $3 for $1 with potatoes and hot dogs. That sometimes used to be my dinner because I didn't have money. I bought all my clothing on the thrift shop. This is probably still one of my favorite places to buy clothing, because for years, that was the only place I could go and afford clothing, and afford shoes from the thrift shop. But I remain focused. I remain focused on what I wanted to do. I wanted to go to school. I want to study.
You're listening to the voice of Cruz Fuchsman, a graduate of Hunter College School of Social Work. She's been working with children, individuals, and families for over 30 years. And she works for the New York Psychotherapy and Counseling Center. And we're talking about her journey from the Dominican Republic to the United States. Now, there's so much to unpack here, because you moved quickly out of the conversation about having gotten in a boat. And we're not talking about a yacht. We're talking about a dinghy, a very small boat, wooden, in the open seas. And I'm just shocked that you would immediately think about the complications with immigration policy that created, that you knew nothing about, of course, as a 17-year-old. But that's not what I thought immediately. I'm thinking about the harrowing journey through the Caribbean Ocean, and the Mona Triangle. Can you give us a sense of what that experience was like for you? What did it mean to hop on a boat and traverse the seas?
Well, when you mentioned the Mona Triangle, it's still in my head. That is a very difficult part of the sea to cross. That is when you're thinking, well, I had to do a little prayer, because this is going to be maybe the time that I'm going to drown. Because it is in the Mona Triangle that you see that your truth is, there's a lot of, when you mention, you know, the wooden, the boat what you described, that's exactly what it was. And you are in the Mona Triangle, where it's almost like an earthquake. And this is this little boat flying, getting all types of movement. I remember that it was there when I actually threw up the first time throughout the whole journey in the Mona Triangle. It is traumatic. Just wanted to know that it's so traumatic that I don't swim. And I like to see the ocean, but I don't go in the ocean, because it was on that trip and the Mona Triangle that actually created that trauma for me about being afraid of the which unexplainable. We're talking about something here with you that I actually never had an opportunity to talk about. That Mona Triangle was the most difficult and turbulent part of that journey in that tiny boat made out of wooden and in the open, you know, open waters. And just wanted to say that all these things that that happen to individuals, especially all these traumatic experiences, because getting in the boat and with people that you don't know, and then going through that open ocean, where do you go? I mean, who's going to rescue you if you get into trouble? If you get sick, like I got sick, throwing up the whole time after the Mono Triangle to get to Cabo Rojo in Puerto Rico, what doctor is going to help you? It's devastating. Only when you are desperate for a better life, you will do that. If my brothers and sisters wanted to do that after I did it, and I said, no, don't do that. You don't want to go through that. So none of my brothers and sisters came here through that journey. I actually became a citizen and filed a petition for my family. She brought my siblings, but I would have never allowed them to get on the boat and go through what I went through. It was difficult.
You've been listening to the voice of Cruz Fuchsman. Ms. Cruz is a graduate of Hunter College School of Social Work. She has over 30 years of experience working with children, individuals, and families. Currently, she is the community liaison of New York Psychotherapy and Counseling Center, where she brings information and training on all types of mental health subjects to individuals and communities in the five boroughs. Ms. Cruz, we are out of time, but I'd like to invite you to join us either tomorrow or Wednesday to continue this conversation, and then we will open it up for calls. We've been talking about Ms. Cruz Fuchsman's journey from the Dominican Republic to the United States in a small wooden boat in a dinghy in the 1980s, fleeing poverty and political and economic crisis stirred up in part by U.S. intervention in the Dominican Republic in 1965. There's an open invitation for us to continue this conversation either tomorrow or Wednesday. Will you accept it?
Yes.
And I want you to stay on because I want you to hear the song that we're about to play. So please tune in tomorrow or Wednesday. We will continue this conversation about the trauma of traversing the Caribbean Ocean on a dinghy in search of a better life. You've been listening to Non-Commercial, listener-funded community radio, WBAI at 99.5 FM in New York. It's 7:56 and 54 degrees in Central Park this morning, Tuesday, May 4th, 2021. We're rebuilding the world together and ushering in a new day. This show is produced by Ajamo Sankofa, Ellis Maxwell, and Marcos Maldonado Cruz. Michael G. Haskins is our board operator. We leave you with Visa para un Sueño by Juan Luis Guerra. I'm your host, Johanna Fernandez. See you tomorrow.
Eran las 7 de la mañana. Y uno por uno al matadero. Pues cada cual tiene su presión. Buscando visa para un sueño. Quemándoles la entraña, un formulario de consuelo, con una foto 2x4, que se derrite en el silencio. Eran las 9 de la mañana, Santo Domingo 8 de enero, con la paciencia que se acaba, pues ya no hay visa para un
And you are tuned to 99.5 FM, WBAI and WBAI.org on the web. Once again, that was a very interesting conversation. with Cruz Fuchsman from the New York Psychotherapy Counseling Center. That's www.nypcc.org, and their phone number there is 718-553-3100. And of course, our website here at WBAI, commercial-free and listener-sponsored WBAI. Our website is WBAI.